From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at two Rochester City schools. School number 3, where Angela Rodriguez was teaching her first graders how to read, and school number 8, where Chris Davis was teaching his special ed students about improper fractions. Both young teachers were recently named Interns of the Year for the Career in Teaching program at the Rochester City School District. It's a teacher mentor program where master teachers provide one-on-one support to new teachers like Rodriguez and Davis. And the goal is not only to improve the quality of teaching and learning in the district, but also to reduce teacher turnover in one of the poorest performing districts in New York State by the numbers. Now, last month, when State Education Department Commissioner Mary Ellen Elia was a guest on this program, she emphasized the need for mentoring programs to combat the teacher shortage and improve the quality of education. She discussed the success she saw with the program she developed in Florida. When local education leaders joined us on the program to share their reactions to Elia's work so far, they pointed out that Rochester's nationally recognized career in teaching program is already accomplishing the goals she has set when it comes to mentoring in the district. And Rochester's program even served as a model for Elia's Florida program. So this hour, we hear from new teachers and master teachers who are mentors in the CIT, the Career in Teaching Program, and they're here to discuss the obstacles they face working in districts like this with a lot of challenges, how they think mentoring can help reduce gaps in teacher training and retention, and how it can improve student achievement and teacher diversity in schools. I'd like to welcome our guests to the program, and we mentioned those two teachers, Angela Rodriguez, first grade teacher at Nathaniel Rochester Community School, number 3. Angela, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Chris Davis, special education teacher at Roberto Clemente School, number 8. Chris, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
And Tammy Shaw is a primary school teacher and CIT lead teacher mentor, Angela's mentor as well. Tammy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Stephen Cohen is director for the Career in Teaching program, also a history teacher in the Rochester City School District for more than 20 years. Stephen, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
You started in Rochester, so what, more than 20 years ago?
1990.
Did you have a mentor?
I did. I had a mentor. He was from School Without Walls, and I remember him talking me down from some tough afternoons. I remember he would try and get me to see that the cup is half empty. Is the cup half empty or half full? And I would just wanted to just take the cup and throw it at him. But he provided a whole lot of support, a lot of encouragement. And it was a lifeline in that first year, which is so, so challenging.
I think we should listen to two different sound bites because it's kind of jarring when you listen to these back to back. But let's go ahead and do, because it's really the reason we're here having this conversation right now. The Commissioner of Education for New York State, Mary Ellen Elia, was telling me that, you know, we really don't have a mentor program like this. And of course, I hadn't met Stephen yet. So I'm listening to the Education Commissioner, assuming she's on the money with this. Here's her explanation for why, you know, it might be difficult for New York State as a whole to get this kind of mentoring program, that, the likes of which she had in Florida. Let's listen.
Very expensive.
It was. Mm-hmm. Is that why it's not happening here yet?
Well, I mean, there are ways that we could make some of that occur. It wouldn't be the exact same model, but that's okay. I think it's important for us to have the local districts making decisions about what they think will be very supportive. I was in a very, very large district, over 200,000 students. And in fact, we hired between 900 and 1,200, 1,300 teachers a year. So you had a lot of brand new teachers in all these 270 buildings. You had a lot of places that teachers were brand new and they needed support. But we have here, we have regulation that has schools providing for all new teachers a mentor, if you will, someone who can talk to them and work with them at that school. That happens in a variable way across the state. Maybe that's one of the things we need to look at really strengthening.
Okay, so she talked about strengthening. She's essentially saying New York State as a whole would need what she had in Florida. Adam Urbanski, who is the president of the Rochester Teachers Association, really took those comments. She could have been a little more knowledgeable and gushing about what's happening in Rochester. Here's what Adam Urbanski had to say on this program a couple days later.
I'm laughing because apparently the commissioner has been so busy that she hasn't learned that we have the premier teacher mentoring program in the nation, that her district, where she was superintendent, learned it from us, with $500 million support from the Gates Foundation, that the National Commission on Teaching in America's Future singled out the Rochester Mentor Program as the model for all mentor programs in this country, it's probably the most successful reform we've had.
All right, Stefan, do you agree with Adam there?
Very much. This program's 30 years old, and it was designed by Adam along with the superintendent of schools at the time, Peter McWalters. And they designed it based on a program out of Toledo, Ohio, and that's been used in several other places for peer assistance and review, giving teachers a leadership role in governing their profession. And in one way they do that is to shape the character of the profession by shaping the next generation of teachers. And it was controversial at the time because it gave teachers not only a support role, but they also had a professional responsibility to make sure that new teachers, that they grew professionally, that they pushed themselves. So not only to provide support, but also create challenge to get the most out of the folks entering the profession. And we have been quietly doing our work for the last 30 years.
Too quietly, it seems.
Well, it depends how you look at it. You miss a lot of flack when you're kind of laying low.
Yeah, I imagine you do. Can you do me and the listeners a favor then, Stefan? Mm-hmm. Set the framework for how the mentoring program works, and then we're going to talk to the other panelists about their experience with it. But, you know, for new teachers, how does it work?
So every new teacher that comes into the district, and that includes, I'm going to include in that social workers, counselors, librarians, school psychologists, speech language therapists, library media specialists, everybody who comes into the district gets assigned a lead teacher mentor. The vast majority of our lead teacher mentors are full-time teachers, and that's one of the principles of the program, is that the people providing the support are active practitioners who have been widely recognized by their peers, by their supervisors, as some of the best in the district. It's a very selective process, which is one of the things that makes it a high-quality process. There is ongoing training for those lead teacher mentors. And as soon as we can, in August generally, and then into September, we assign every new person that comes in gets assigned a lead teacher mentor. And they work with them throughout the school year. They are in regular contact, ideally with weekly visits to their classrooms. We can't always visit weekly, but we try and go as close to that as we can. They write status reports in the fall and in the spring. And at the end of the year, while the vast, vast majority of the work they do with the new teachers is to support them in whatever they need in their classroom with their specific students and their specific situation, it's very customized support. But at the end of the year, that lead teacher mentor also makes a recommendation that stands alongside the supervisor's recommendation for the continuation of that teacher. So that added responsibility is part of what made this a very innovative program 30 years ago.
I don't know if you've got numbers or just a general sense, but how often would a mentor at the end of a year not recommend continuation?
One of the things we're very proud of is that if there's a situation where a teacher is not going to be recommended for continuation, that conversation has begun 6 to 8 months earlier. So if there's a teacher who is struggling, the mentor will reach out to, they'll let me know, we'll provide resources, additional resources, and we do everything we can to help that teacher succeed. But at the end of the day, if that teacher cannot, if a teacher is struggling and this is just not for them, there's no way to, there's someone holding up a mirror to show them this. It's a very humane way to say to someone, well, you've done what you could, we've done everything we could to support you, and maybe this just isn't for you. The shocking thing is how rarely that happens. What happens more often is a teacher comes to their mentor and says, I can't do this. I'm ready to quit. And the mentor is able to find in that teacher's practice the strengths to build on. And at the end of the year, at our final meeting, I always ask a show of hands, just an informal poll. We've got 150 mentors in the room. Raise your hand if at some point during this year, one of your interns said, that's it, I quit. I can't come back here on Monday. And over 2/3 of the mentors raise their hands. So the vast majority of our work is in supporting people so that in these very difficult teaching conditions, they can do the best they can and succeed.
I think these the two teachers, first year or going into second year teachers now who are with us, are going to give us a sense for what that is like. And I'll start with Angela. For you, you come into Rochester. Where'd you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in Greece, and then I moved to Ronicoy.
Okay, and you're teaching now in Rochester. Was the job competitive? Were you thrilled to get it? What was your mindset coming in at first?
At first, I went to the new teacher hire in February, and I went through the interview process, and then they were told me, you know, if we want you, we'll contact you. So it was about maybe a month later, she contacted me, and she was like, we want you as a teacher. I was like, okay, great, but we can't give you any information about, like, where you're going to be, what mm-hmm. school, you know, what grade. I'm like, okay, so I didn't find out until the end of August, new teacher orientation, because I was on a vacation during the first 3 days, so I didn't go. So the next day, I didn't get hired until, you know, probably 5 days before school started. I had an interview with the principal, Rodney Moore, at number 3 school. I got a call from the secretary saying, we want you to come in, we want to interview you. Okay, so I went in and I had an interview, and he said, I have first grade and I have sixth grade. I want to hire you. You pick which grade you want. And
you chose first grade.
Yeah, I chose first grade. I definitely loved the little kids. I went from nannying 4- and 5-year-olds before that. So it was kind of an easy transition anyways to go right to first grade. During my student teaching, I worked normally in second grade, so it was kind of familiar. It wasn't too far. But that beginning stages was very hectic because I had no clue where I was going to be, what I was going to be teaching. So kind of scary.
What were you most concerned about?
Oh, most concerned about failing, honestly.
But what does failing mean?
Well, because since I'm coming right from nannying to teaching, a lot of, you know, teachers go through student teaching, they go through substitute teaching, and then they transition over to teaching. I just went basically right from nannying with no, you know, teacher responsibility. Like, mm-hmm. all I had to do, it's kind of the behavior management kind with the kids,
sure.
but not, like, the academic-wise. So you go from straight, like, kind of being a mom just to being a teacher. So that transition for me, I was just a little more concerned that I wouldn't be able to do it just because I didn't have more experience like some fellow first-year teachers did.
So the academic structure part of it worried
yes.
you? Okay. And you met Tammy in September of last year?
Yes, the first week of school we met.
Okay, and what are those initial meetings like, Tammy? What's the process like there?
Well, just getting to know the person, finding out the needs and making them feel welcome and seeing what do they need to get that first week off to a good start. So we brainstorm and look at what she has, look at the room setup. And Angela is a very organized person, so her room was beautiful by the time I got there. She had already thought of that. But it's very overwhelming because you have to think of multiple different things and learn how to take attendance, how to find the resources you need, and where do I go, and how do I pick up my kids from lunch, and things like that. Just all these little things add up to a successful day and make you want to stay.
Yeah, and Tammy, when Angela says she was worried about failing, I thought of my first week here hosting this program. I think just about anybody who starts a new job, the first couple of days you think, I'm sort of play acting here. Am I really doing this? Do I know what I'm doing? Do they know that I don't really know what I'm doing? Are they going to tell me this was the wrong decision? And then, yeah. of course, you're a month in and 5 months in and you start to feel like I'm in a rhythm here, but you can't yeah. get that right away. And you have a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Were her questions similar to what you have seen and come to experience?
Yes. And there's a cycle new teachers go through, and it goes up and down and takes you through the, oh, I'm so excited, so it's okay. It's going to be okay. And then you hit a period of time where you think, I can't have the energy for this, or I can't figure it out. And then there's
you got the survival phase, the disillusionment phase,
yes.
and then rejuvenation.
Yeah, and so by the end of the year, people are starting to think, okay, next year I'm going to do this differently. I got this.
What's the disillusionment phase, by the way? Disillusion about what?
If you've ever seen a movie that features a heroic teacher figure, and you come into school and you're going to change the world and you're going to
change. Every kid's going to have a better life immediately.
It's the impact of your impact on those students will be so far reaching. You will be canonized. They will go to the Hall of Fame. They will be television specials. And then you get into the reality of the day-to-day grind that really undermines the reason you went into teaching in the first place, how to manage all those distractions mm-hmm. in order to do your best work with kids. Teaching, I think teaching is one of the best jobs and one of the most rewarding careers that there is. But it's a lot of work. Not everyone's ready for how much work it is. And you have to understand what you can control, what you can't control, and take. Sometimes you need some help to take one thing at a time.
Yeah, it can be very, very exhausting. So figuring out your priorities and what you have to get done in order to make the next day a survival day and to make it good for the kids and good for the teachers.
I also wonder, you know, Angela, now that you're a year into this, if you think the biggest challenge has changed, because I remember my first year, the biggest challenge was literally knowing how technology functions. How do I record a promo for the next day's show? How am I editing using the software? And that was, I just felt helpless. And then you learn that and you deal with it. Now, my fear of failure is I'm going to let the audience down. I am not going to somehow balance a program fairly. I'm going to be unfair to a guest. I will be unprepared. I will waste my listeners' time. And I lose a lot of sleep on stuff like that. But that's very different than the early days when you're just trying to function. Where is everything? You know, where's this person's office? What is this building? How many floors do we have? Do you now, going into your second year, feel like your biggest challenge is very different than it was a year ago?
Definitely. I think just my biggest challenge now is basically taking what I learned in my first year and try to evolve it. So I already know going into it, you know, what I'm expecting and what I am expecting from my kids. But now my biggest challenge, I think, because since I'm going to have a whole new group, it's going to be, you know, getting to know them on a more personal level. I feel like I did that last year, but I feel like I could, you know, obviously do that more. And it comes with experience, and you just have to be around the kids in the classroom and, you know, navigate the classroom in order to know their strengths and their weaknesses. My biggest challenge, I think, for this upcoming school year with a group of kids that I'm going to have is differentiating, because a lot of them have a lot of different needs. Mm-hmm. So I have, you know, the low kids, and I have a medium kids, and I have the high kids. And usually the high kids kind of get lost in space because, you know, they're so up there that they don't really need a teacher on top of them helping them. So my challenge this year,
the kids who are ahead, you want to continue to make sure they're challenged.
Yes, I want to. Yes. I feel like last year that's something that I kind of, you know, lacked a little bit just because it was my first year, and that comes with experience. But definitely this year I want to focus a little bit more on those higher kids and pushing them even more than just letting them do their own thing.
Yeah, that's great. And especially kindergarten, first grade, there's a wide range of who gets up to speed at different levels and what comes easily and what comes much more difficult. Can you paint a little picture for our listeners? You teach at Nathaniel Rochester Community School No. 3. You know, there's a lot of discussion on the challenges the teachers will have in a district with high poverty. What's it like in your school?
I mean, it definitely is high poverty. Coming in, I honestly didn't know any of, you know, the economic status of my student. And you don't really know as a teacher, but you can see day to day, like what the kids wear, how they act, if they're malnourished. So usually as a teacher, like I keep clothes, shoes, underwear, food, stuff in my classroom just for that, because I'll have kids who come in and they can't wait to sit down for breakfast. And I'll have someone who would just like take 3 cereals just because they didn't eat the night before. So yeah. Especially in low poverty, like I'm prepared for the situation because I know some of them are going to be wearing the same clothes 3 times a week. Some of them are going to be hungry. So I make sure to feed them if they're hungry and, you know, to give them clothes if they need it.
Yeah. Do you have conversations with someone like Tammy about the struggle that you might feel in that there comes a limit to what you can do? I mean, you can't probably personally afford to clothe every child in your class. But you want to be there in case you see a child struggling. Sometimes it's just having clean clothes. Sometimes you don't want a child to be picked on. There's a million different things. And you probably, knowing the way they talked about you before today, they have such high regard for you. You're the kind of teacher who probably wants to solve all of those problems.
Exactly.
Is that difficult? Did you talk to Tammy about how to do some of that?
I didn't talk to Tammy necessarily about the clothes and aspect, but we do have a volunteer program in our school who they come once a week and they take the kids. And I reached out to them, and even they reached out to me because they noticed this one girl, you know, wears the same outfit maybe every other day. Mm-hmm. So they're like, can we buy her stuff? So I have volunteers in the classroom. I was fortunate at school No. 3 that we had police officer volunteers. We have a program called G2. So we had so many volunteers in the classroom, and they wanted to help out also. So it wasn't just me on my own. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Tammy would help me in all the other aspects outside of the clothing, like emotional needs.
Sure,
definitely, especially as a first year student. Like, I have no clue. I have a girl screaming, crying on the floor for no absolute reason. Like, I'm like, I didn't do anything. Nobody else did anything. Like, what am I supposed to do? So Tammy was definitely there for that emotional support.
Talk me through that, Tammy. What are those conversations
The nice thing for me is I can sit back and kind of be the armchair quarterback and see maybe things that the teachers aren't seeing because they're so in the moment and trying to address everything. So I can sit back and see where maybe something could be done differently or added in, or what that child might need from Angela. So Angela was so conscientious about just her students, getting to know her students and knowing their needs. That was very helpful for me, and that's not always the case, but so she wanted to know, you know, how do I meet the student's academic need, and how do I, you know, we talked about that range, how do we meet that range, and how do I structure my day so that I can get in all of these different things that my building is expecting me to do, and how do I do small groups and things like that. But yeah, we do talk a lot about that social-emotional and how to reflect the students' feelings and bring them from where they are to where we need them to be. And it's hard. It's hard to not be, like, you know, take that home with you.
Well, especially if you're worried about their home situation, their home life. Mm-hmm. How is attendance for your school, for your class?
For my class, honestly, it was actually pretty good. I had probably like one kid who would be tardy. He came to school every day, but he would come late. But from the majority, I had mostly every student there.
Okay, that's great. And we had, when we had Anna Murbanski in last week, we had one of the other guests was New York State Teacher of the Year, Christopher Albrecht, who said that he thinks as a fourth grade teacher, he teaches students, but he tries to, as much as is appropriate, get to understand their family situation, how much support do they have, how much support do they not have. You probably got a pretty good picture as the year went on with that. How difficult is it for you when you know some kids are going home to a loving home situation, encouragement on learning, maybe a parent or two parents or siblings who will read with them, and then others who you feel like I'm worried about what home looks like. How difficult is that?
Yeah, definitely this first year I could tell because I sent home daily homework, even if it was just like half a sheet with 5 problems. I sent them home, and the kids knew to do their homework. So I could tell right off the bat like who had parents who were with the kids doing the homework. I could also tell what parents did the kids' homework, and I also can tell what parents, you know, didn't even bother because it would just be in the same exact spot and in the same exact placement that I put it in their folder the next day. And I also did classroom management on Dojo, which is like an online app that parents sign up to, and they can see their kids' progress throughout the whole day. So I can even tell right off the bat from that, I had half of my kids' parents sign up and half of them not. So I could tell right off the bat from that, like, what parents were going to be involved and what parents weren't. So I kind of tried to help those kids that I knew wasn't getting that home support. So when they come in the morning, I'm packing their bags and stuff, I would like, you know, can you bring me your folders? They bring it to me, and they're like, I didn't do my homework. I was like, okay, well, how about we sit and do it, like, right now before, you know, you eat breakfast and before all that, just because I just don't want them to worry. Some of them came in the morning and would hand me the folder. I didn't do my homework. I'm like, it's okay. Let's do it right now. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of them, they get stressed out. Even as first graders, like, they can't control that homework situation because some of them can't even go home and do it on their own. So they need the parent. And it was just hard seeing those parents that weren't involved, especially in first grade when they kind of need the parents to be involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what would you say your first year would have been like without Tammy, without a mentor?
Probably horrible. I probably would have just kind of felt alone, honestly. I mean, I had my first grade team who was actually pretty awesome academic-wise. Like, they gave me the material I needed to use to teach, but more of, like, the underlying behavior issues. I think Tammy actually helped me that because she's another eye in the classroom. So when I'm teaching, she's watching me teach, and she's watching what I'm doing. She's watching what the kid's doing. So just let another set of eyes, you know, to give me positive reinforcement and, you know, comment on what I'm doing, what I can do wrong. Like, even, like, a little hand gesture. Like, she definitely helped me so many times with that. and just quick, like, attention grabbers from the kids. Like,
so you liked when she was even in the classroom?
I loved it. Like, Tammy would come probably once a week. Sometimes she would even just show up randomly. And, like, the kids loved Tammy. Like, they would all stand. If I was teaching or reading a book, they would all just stand up and run over to Tammy. Miss Shaw! And I'm like, okay, we can continue this later. So, I mean, they loved she came in. Great. Just because I made it that kind of classroom. Like, visitors are always welcome. Yeah. Like, and they loved it.
No, that's wonderful to hear. And as much as you know, Stefan brings up the whole kind of cycles and the little disillusionment, did you have a rejuvenation too? Do you have moments, especially late in the year, where maybe a child was struggling to get something and got it, or you know, you saw a breakthrough or something that said to you, you know, all the fears that I've had, maybe this is for me. I can definitely do this.
Yeah, definitely. During our end of the year assessments, which takes place like the last 3 weeks of school, you know, we sit down with every single kid and go over every single, you know, ELA and skill they need to know in order to move on to second grade for, you know, English and math. So we go through like, it's kind of like a test. So it's either a one-on-one test or like a group. And actually seeing that all my kids, in the beginning of the school year, you have to do like a projected target. So this is what I think my kid is going to get at the end of the school year. And honestly, all my kids did way better than what I projected them to do based on the beginning of the school year. And that just kind of made me proud. Like, hey, maybe they did learn from me this whole school year because, you know, they've grown so much. Even my ones that were struggling. I had a kid coming in at reading at preschool level. You know, by the end of first grade, she was reading probably like a middle of kindergarten, which is, you know, she's still behind, but she made tremendous progress going from pre-K reading all the way to like the middle of kindergarten. That to me, honestly, those little successes, you know, make it all worth it.
And you can see they're going to get there.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was able to be at Angela's end of the year celebration, and she'd created this PowerPoint starting from the beginning of the year with the students' pictures, and you could see the parents, and I think they were so proud, but I think she also empowered them to say, oh, wow, my student is really important. My child has some capabilities, and this is how I can help. And so it was really, really wonderful to see them and her and watch the students.
Yeah. Throughout the year. I mean, I don't know if a lot of teachers do that, but I made it an effort for me to do it during every like event, even like the little things that they were just writing in their notebook. I would go over with my phone and take pictures of all these. So by the end of the school year, I had like maybe 300, 400 pictures. And so at the end of the year, I put a whole slideshow together. I invited parents, and they just got to see, you know, their child grow from the very, you know, first day of school, where the first day of first grade sign, to, you know, the very end, the last day of school, where their end of the year, you know, I made it to second grade. And
One of the exciting things about a situation like that, and Angela just really excelled, is that Tammy can take some of the ideas that Angela's introduced in her classroom, and then she brings those not only into her own practice, but to all the other people that she coaches. Mm-hmm. So the other teachers that Tammy was working with had very different issues, very different problems, some of them the same. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest things about our CIT program, the way it's structured, is that it really re-energizes our experienced teachers to think about their own practice.
Yes.
And to just re-inspire them in looking for creative solutions to engage families, for example.
How many teachers are you mentoring?
Last year, I believe I had 12 people.
Wow.
And so at one point.
Right. And Tammy's unusual in that she's fully released from the classroom. Most of our teacher mentors have one or two interns.
Just because efficiency.
Well, and because they're not released from the classroom.
Yeah, yeah.
They are compensated, which is another thing that makes our program work. And they go through rigorous training, rigorous selection, rigorous training, and ongoing training throughout the school year. So it's a commitment. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But what it does for you, you have to be have a minimum of 7 years, but what it does to you as an experienced teacher to work with this next group of folks coming in and to see these successes and then spread the love.
Yeah.
We're going to get Chris Davis's story next year. And I got to say, you know, this program, we're having this conversation for a number of reasons, not the least of which is Stefan's right. They've kind of kept their heads down. And this is to those of us in the news media, it's a little under the radar, this mentoring program that the city of Rochester, the school district, has had for 30 years now,
30
right?
Years,
about 30 years.
In one form or another.
And so when the Commissioner of Education for New York State, Mary Ellen Elia, says maybe the whole state needs something like this, you can look at Rochester for a program that has three decades in doing this. And if you are thinking about teacher shortages and the question on retention, which we will get to this hour, if you're thinking about teaching, it's important for new teachers to know that you will have this in Rochester. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is a value that doesn't exist in every district. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and get Chris Davis's experience as a special ed teacher at Roberto Clemente School No. 8. You just heard Angela Rodriguez, a first grade teacher at Nathaniel Rochester Community School No. 3. Tammy Shaw, who is Angela's mentor and a CIT lead teacher mentor in the program, and Stephen Cohen, director of the Career in Teaching program. We're right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a group pushing for anti-racism training in the Rochester Central School District says one of the big problems with American public schools is a Eurocentric approach to teaching history. They say it's racist, that there's much more beyond the borders of Europe to teach. So what do they think non-racist historical teaching would look like? We'll talk about it Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Chris Davis has a bit of a different story when it comes to your path into teaching, because you just heard Angela Rodriguez explaining that she essentially went from nannying 4- and 5-year-olds to teaching first grade. You had a bit of a different path. You grew up where?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and also on Long Island.
Okay, and you taught for, where did you teach before coming to Rochester?
So before moving to Rochester, I taught for a charter school for 2 years, first and second grade, special education. Took a little break in between that, and I taught pre-vocational classes for adults with special needs.
I saw in a little video the district put together, too, that teaching is something that you have already found to be more rewarding than a different career that you could have pursued. What was that?
Right. So right after college, I did not go into teaching, but I was in banking for about 2 years. Not rewarding for me at all. I knew that I needed to do more with my life, and I wanted to be more beneficial. So I did go back to grad school, and that's when I started studying teaching.
Now, I am not at all casting any sort of skepticism. I'm taking you at face value here. But most people who go into business, banking, I think they do not follow the path that you've gone, even if they don't necessarily feel it fulfilling. Is that just sort of in your DNA that it has to feel good to you? What wasn't feeling good about it?
I'm more of a person that wants to take my own responsibility for social change. I didn't feel that that was the path that was just for me. It wasn't anything that I could see myself really being beneficial in.
Okay. And so you end up teaching for, what, 2 years before coming here?
Yes.
Okay. You came to Rochester. How did you get the job? And tell me the mindset you had, because you're not from here.
Right.
Moving here, were you excited to do it? Was it a competitive? I mean, every teaching position is competitive, but what was that like for you?
I actually had an amazing year. Getting into the school district was something. I took a break from teaching. And I knew, again, I wasn't following the path that I should have, and just went for it. And I said, okay, let me give it a try with the school district. Teaching certification had to be updated, so that was a process by itself. But I made the right contacts, the right connections through a church I'm a member at, and she gave me the connection to HR for the school district. And things just happened to move so quickly. And it had to be meant to be, just how I got my interview scheduled. I was hired the day before that we would do back to school. So I was hired on a Friday. It was a holiday weekend. That Monday, that Tuesday, teachers were back at school. That Wednesday, the kids were in school. So really, I had no time to prepare. So I was grateful for my mentor.
Wow.
Who definitely helped me out.
I mean, similar to Angela, but I mean, we're talking days to get ready here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what for you, what do you remember a year ago now, moving into that role? What did you... Fear might be the wrong word. What caused you the most anxiety?
Everything, because everything was just starting like right away. The most, I had a very challenging classroom. So it's an 8-1-2 setting where students have a lot of needs. So it's social emotional needs.
When you say 8-1-2, explain that.
Okay, I'm sorry. 8 students, 1 teacher, and then 2 adult support staff. Students have varying needs. It could be academic, social emotional. Different medical diagnoses mm-hmm. that are present. So just taking all that into consideration and knowing that I'm still responsible for these kids' academic growth. So
how old are the kids?
So they were 4th and 5th, so about 9, 10, almost 11.
Mm-hmm.
And just how, even despite the diagnoses, how can I move them to the next level academically and socially?
Okay. And maybe a week in, and then a month in, and then 3 months in. How do you sort of feel that evolution of what you felt like was your biggest concern changing? What was that like for you?
I think I had to know my kids. And it's a certain mindset. I feel like when you have a student with a disability, they have learned helplessness. So they use their disability as a crutch. And adults, now that they know that they have a disability, they also don't expect much of them. So I had to change their mindset and change my mindset, saying that, you know what, I can implement these things that they can achieve success emotionally, academically. And I want to say the first few months of the school year, that's what we did. Just, you know, skill building, character building, and just, you know, enforcing a sense within themselves that they can actually achieve success.
Awesome. Now, for you, when it comes to mentoring, what were the conversations like? What do you remember about that?
Between my mentor and I?
Yeah.
She was so helpful because she also worked with a lot of the same kids the year before with a different teacher who was also new. So she gave me a lot of heads up about their needs. And we actually were able to bounce ideas off of each other. She, you know, she let me know what to expect, so I wasn't completely blind going in. And it was a lot of, you know, different ideas. So what we can do to make sure that they change behaviors, like staying in the classroom. They're at that age where they would just get up and walk out. Or what can we do when there's cursing? What could we do if a fight breaks out? And then the steps that we could take to eliminate that.
A lot of problem solving goes on with mentors and interns.
Yes.
Yeah, and so how do you rate yourself at diffusing those tensions now compared to a year ago? You pretty good, you feel like, at handling those adverse moments?
Definitely. There was such a drastic change in my classroom between September and February. It's a huge difference.
Why?
Again, and also in my school building, we do have a lot of emotional support. Thankfully, we do have staff, along with myself, and we work together to not only look at the academics, but the emotional part. So it's building that relationship. Seeing what drives them. There are some reward systems that we have to put in place to get them to say, okay, it's worth it for me to stay in the classroom. It's worth it for me to keep it my hands to myself. And, you know, I'm very transparent with my kids. So I tell them, you know, you're getting older. You're approaching your preteens. You put your hands on people in public, they're not going to be so forgiving of you. So you have to prepare yourself now for life soon in your teens because it comes sooner than you think.
And what do you think the public gets wrong the most about the importance and the challenge of maintaining order in a school classroom setting like that?
Oh, it's so important. Kids are going to be kids regardless. Kids have never changed. It's the adults that have changed and adapted. But if you have, you know, your expectations, I tell my kids all the time, I expect you to stay in the classroom. I expect you to be safe. And if you're consistent with that, then, you know, it follows along. But you can't be just one teacher consistent in your room. The music teacher has to be on board. The PE teacher has to be on board. The art teacher, the principals have to be on board. So if you can set your standards and your expectations across the board, then your building and your school and different classes, your students will be able to adapt.
Hmm. And now, in the mentoring program, what would you say to a new teacher who has the same kind of anxieties about the value of the mentoring program?
It's definitely valuable. I would say use your mentor as a resource because they're there to help. Some people, they're kind of anxious when another adult comes in your classroom and they're observing you. But it's to help you and to better you and to give you as much support as you need.
Did you like when the mentor was in the room with you?
Yeah, I love my mentor. We got along so well. And she definitely helped me a lot. So I definitely enjoyed the experience.
Now you've got a picture of what this mentoring program is like in the city of Rochester. And I think it's relevant and important to ask, and I'll start with Stefan on this. We talked about teacher evaluations with the commissioner, with President Urbanski from the Teachers Association, with other teachers. There's a lot of different opinions on how teachers should be evaluated. The commissioner is clear that she thinks test scores are weighted too heavily. But Adam Urbanski on this program said last week, he said, look, doctors, physicians are primarily reviewed by their peers because those are the people who know the jobs best. And it sounds like your mentoring program is a big first step in an evaluation model, which might be not just for helping the district say, hey, should we recommend continuation? Should we have a conversation with the mentor? You've been there. But should the entire evaluation system look a little bit more like you do? And Stefan, maybe you're biased on that one because you love the program, but how do you feel about that?
Extremely biased, but for the most rational of reasons.
Okay, sure.
So Rochester has been an innovator in teacher evaluation for some time prior to what's known as APPR, which is the statewide evaluation system. Left to our own devices here in this community, with the partnerships that we have, district and union, on these issues, we have come up with some very innovative approaches. We had the APART reforms from back in the late 80s mm-hmm. that extended where teachers could drive their professional development and be evaluated based on a mutually agreed upon project that actually means something to them and their students. We have experimented with peer review as part of the evaluation process, and that has been preserved in an independent evaluation component that we've managed to hang on to despite all the changes from the state.
And you have to be a mentor to be a peer evaluator.
That's right. That's right. So this program has been, we have our hands, we publish the teacher evaluation guide that the entire district uses. We've had our hands in this in a while. It's part of peer assistance and review. The bulk of our work is new teacher induction and mentoring, but we also are involved with teacher evaluation. If the state would allow us the opportunity to return to some local control there, you'd see a much more effective evaluation system. But we also work with experienced teachers and even tenured struggling teachers. It's a far-reaching program, and the reason it's still around and it works is because it's negotiated in the collective bargaining agreement, so it's in our contract, and because it's a jointly run program by district and union. The superintendent places 6 members on our CIT governing panel, and the union president places 6 members on our CIT governing panel. And that's who I answer to every 3 weeks, and we talk about every aspect of the program's operation. So your question was about teacher evaluation. With what we do with new teachers, it's an intensive mentor support. In many districts, a mentoring program is, call me if you need me, here's my number. And our mentors are compensated and have expectations for the amount of feedback that they're going to provide and the kind of support they're going to provide. At the end of the day, that joint committee, that joint governing panel, takes a look at what has been recommended by the mentor, what's been recommended by the supervisor. 95-98% of the time, they're in full agreement. If someone's been struggling that much, they've usually chosen to leave prior to that point. And if there's a disagreement, it gets settled in a very friendly and with fidelity, looking over all the different performance documents. It's a wonderful blueprint for a humane, constructive system that respects the professionalism of the teachers and holds them accountable for the success of their students.
So why are we not doing that more often?
Well, I have some theories, but you only have an hour program. this has been 10 years of hard times for teachers in terms of a accountability-based reform movement that's fueled by many very well-meaning people and some real opportunists and some entrepreneurs and any number of people with skin in the game, many of which want the best for our students, many of which are playing an angle. The result is a kind of a very top-down approach. And what we pride ourselves on in this program is we are bottom-up. We send our mentors to work with teachers where they are, with their kids, with their specific needs. Even listening to Chris and Angela talk about what their needs were, differences. Some teachers come in with 20 years experience, but they've never taught in an urban setting. Some teachers are curriculum designers extraordinaire, but they don't have a toolbox for different rituals and routines to help students line up before they go to their next class.
Sure.
So it's about finding those teacher strengths and building on them at the ground level, ground up. The reason we're stuck with this APPR system is because some people believe that if they flip a switch far enough away from the classroom, all will be well once it dribbles down to where the kids actually work.
Do you, as teachers, Angela and Chris, there's a lot of talk about test scores, and you know, you teach at different levels, and it's a different approach there. But now, having taught for a year here in Rochester, this community is still trying to figure out what amount of a teacher evaluations a teacher's total evaluation should be based on test scores and the performance of their students academically. What do you think about that, Angela?
I mean, our test scores, based on our APBR rating, we determine our test scores at the end of September for our kids. So at the end of September, like, you don't honestly know your kids that well. Like, you know them only from the 3 weeks that you spent with them. And usually during that 3 weeks, you're doing rituals and routines, getting to know them on a personal level. You're not really diving into their academics. So when you're required to go into the system and rate them, if they're going to get a 4 between a scale of 1 to 9, you know, I don't really think that's really accurate because you don't know them academically at that point of the school year.
Tammy, you want to jump in?
Yeah, they're asked to make a student learning objective and make a prediction on who's going to achieve what level. And that happens early in the year. And then that affects.
So there's a lot of pressure, it would seem, even just a few weeks in to kind of get that right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a big, you know, guessing game sometimes about students that you haven't had a chance to spend any time with.
Okay, so there's one possible pitfall to it. Chris, how do you feel about it?
I have students with special needs, so there's a lot that comes into play, like on the day of testing. They might have test anxiety, or something could happen at home the morning of, and it affects their scores. So there could be great growth. They could be bad test takers. So there could be great growth, but the test will never accurately show that. So they're basing your performance on as a teacher based on information that's not fair, correct?
Yeah, okay. And Stefan, by the way, as I kick it back to Stefan, I want to read this quick email. Robert says, I took AP U.S. History with Mr. Cohen in 2005 at School of the Arts. He was one of the greatest educators I've ever had. I still have my copy of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. I can never thank Mr. Cohen enough for the knowledge he imparted on me. Please let him know how great he was and still is, and thank you. You know, so the teachers in the room, that's going to be you guys. And so for this cycle, as we, you know, we got a few minutes left here. I'm fascinated by the cycle that Stefan described earlier, that mentors help young teachers navigate, which is what idealism and then the crash or the disillusionment and then sort of the rejuvenation that comes. What I would be scared of is cynicism. Once you get past the disillusionment, the cynicism that, well, I'm not going to change every life that I thought I was going to change, and you know what, at least it's a job and I'll do what I need to do, but, you know, that's life, you know. There has to be some sort of acceptance that you're not going to reach the idealistic level with still a goal of this email that I just read. How do you balance that, and how do you help that with that?
Well, first of all, I have checks in the mail, Robert. you can't see how red I've turned. But that does tell you something about the kind of surprise. The surprise rewards that hit you when you least expect them in this career. And keep you going. So speaking of keeping going, how do you prevent a teacher from having seen that the reality may not be what the teacher had expected, or the disappointments, the compromises that you have to make, the things that are out of your control that you can't fix? How do you maintain a positive focus on what you can fix and what you can and how you can grow and can, how you can help students? And one way you do that is you have those kinds of conversations. And one of the things that, and Tammy can vouch for me here, is that we talk a lot about it, our trainings, is that important role that we have of being that positive force in that teacher's arc, of reminding them what it is that drew them to the profession, there's a moral component to the work, and to help them realize and recognize the positive impact that they're having so that they won't become cynical, because there's a lot of cranky in the Rochester City School District. There's plenty of opportunities to run into someone who will have that kind of conversation that could turn to a cynical bent. So Carl O'Connell, who was the first director of this program and one of the architects, his first rule of mentoring was never meet with your intern in the faculty lounge. That's where the cranky lives. Yeah. You know? And I said this
venting
recently.
Sessions galore. Yeah.
And for a first year teacher coming in, I'm dramatizing for effect.
No, of course.
There's some wonderfully enriching teacher faculty rooms. Yeah. Adam heard me say that once, and he said, "You know, maybe your energy can change the tone of that." So, but one of the things our mentors really work hard on is to encourage that optimism, you know, with that dose of reality. And the way you do that is you encourage reflection. You encourage someone who can reflect honestly about their own practice so that when you're not there, they are thinking like there's a mentor in the room and they are ongoing striving to grow and to improve and to do even more for their kids. And sometimes that's about relationships with the other adults. That's a big part of our work too. Yes. You heard Chris talk about it, about the importance. You're asking someone brand new sometimes to a profession, and they're coming in and they're leading a team of two other adults who may have been working in that building with those kids for 10 years before you got there. And you are the captain of that team. You have to work with the other teachers. You may not always see eye to eye. How do you deal with the fact that you come in with all these great ideas and then the other teachers say, ah, that's not going to work?
Well, congratulations to the new teachers in the room here. And as we wrap the program, two quick questions. You're going to hear the music, which means we're out. So how long does the mentorship relationship last?
Oh, ongoing. I still have people from 10 years ago that will call me for advice or to share like a yay. You should see this.
Awesome. Yeah. And Stefan, if the commissioner of the state calls you and says, can we afford this across the state?
It's the cost of teacher turnover. It's worth every penny. And we have retained our 5-year retention rate is around 84%. National averages are between 50 and 70%.
So you're beating the national average on retention?
By a lot.
Okay. Really interesting stuff. And I'm glad that this came to the surface in the last week or so, because we learned a lot about what's going on here. Thanks to Stefan Cohen, director of the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us, Evan.
Good luck to Christopher Davis, Chris, and Angela Rodriguez. Have a great second year here
thank
in Rochester.
You.
Thank you so much. Tammy Shaw, thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon.